Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Claire Roth, sitting in for Ann this week. The Ohio House on Thursday unanimously voted to remove Larry Householder as House Speaker after his indictment by a federal grand jury on racketeering conspiracy charges. Then a few hours later, the chamber voted along party lines to name Representative Bob Kupp as his replacement. The Lima Republican and former state Supreme Court justice told reporters he knows that there's work to do to restore the public's trust.
So we're going to operate above board. We're going to make sure that all our members understand or have an opportunity to inquire about legislation that comes. And hopefully be able to set a good example that way.
Here to discuss Kupp and his leadership is our weekly reporter roundtable. Joining us is Jackie Borchert, Columbus Bureau Chief for the Cincinnati Inquirer. Welcome back, Jackie. And Andy Chow, reporter for the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Hi, Andy.
Good morning, Claire.
And Jeremy Pelzer, politics reporter for Cleveland.com. Welcome, Jeremy.
Hi, Claire. Happy Monday.
Happy Monday. So let's just get started. Householder was arrested on the 21st. Why did it take a week and some change to vote him out of the top spot?
Well, first of all, they had to decide exactly what to do and how to vote him out of office. There were a number of potential ways they could do it. In fact, even the Attorney General, Dave Yost, got involved with his idea. And eventually they just decided, well, we can. And then they had to decide, of course, who to replace him with. There, it was not immediately clear. And in fact, Bob Kupp ended up getting the nomination from the House Republicans by a single vote over Jim Butler from the Dayton area. So there were a lot of housekeeping things, no pun intended, that they had to go through to get this to happen.
Well, and let's talk a little bit about that behind the scenes. How was Kupp chosen? Why did the GOP feel like he was their man?
He was chosen because he brought together a number. So this is a continuation, as you might remember. Larry Householder was chosen over Ryan Smith to become Speaker in 2019. And Bob Kupp at the time voted for Ryan Smith. But at the same time, he was also considered by many this time around to have support from a number of Householder people. So he kind of brought a number of disparate groups together. He's also considered to be a pretty nice guy and someone who's not exactly as power hungry as Larry Householder was.
Well, and I was going to ask, Householder's election as Speaker involved a lot of wheeling and dealing, getting Democrats to vote for him when Republicans wouldn't. The push to get him elected as Speaker is part of the racketeering conspiracy that he was arrested for. So when we look at Kupp, did he get any votes on the Democratic side or no?
He did not. No, this time the Democrats, in fact, I believe they put out a statement that said, essentially, we're not going to be fooled by this again. They voted for Larry Householder, but this time they put out a statement saying, basically, we don't trust any of them on the other side of the aisle.
Well, and the other thing that the Democrats brought up that didn't, you know, come to pass, so to speak, is getting Householder out of the legislature altogether. So they voted him out as Speaker, but they stopped short of removing him from office. Why was that?
Well, I'll leave it to a couple of my other colleagues to chime in here, too.
Yeah, Jackie, tell me what you think about why was Householder removed as Speaker, but not removed from the legislature altogether?
So I think there's some confusion of what the limitations are of removing someone from their position. So Householder is still on the ballot as of today for his to run for his House seat again. A couple write-in candidates have emerged and are kind of riding the coattails of this story and getting a lot of earned media, and rightfully so, for those campaigns. But as we saw with this election for a new Speaker, and even just going about the business of removing an absent Speaker from the position, a lot of this stuff is unprecedented and hasn't happened before. And so there's been debate over what are the rules to follow and the procedures. And we even saw Attorney General Dave Yost, who's the state's top attorney and law enforcement official, had laid out an analysis of how he felt things should go and the process they should follow, and House Republicans, you know, differed with him on that. So I think a lot of it is just we don't know the extent of what decisions can be made now and what will happen in the future.
Well, and I recall Representative Kupp saying something similar of you can vote to remove someone once, but you can't vote to remove them twice. And so there's a worry that he'll get removed and then voted back in, right?
Right. That he'll stay on the ballot and he'll, you know, they remove him now. So let's say they remove him now. He's still technically on the ballot for this fall.
And no one else is. He's running unopposed, right?
Right. Let's say he gets reelected and then he comes back in January and their hands are tied in not being able to kick him out again.
Mm. So let's talk a little bit more about Kupp as a person. You know, Jeremy kind of gave us a bit of a rundown of why they ended up choosing him. But what should we expect from a Kupp-led House compared to, let's say, a householder-led House? Andy, can you chime in there?
Yeah. So Bob Kupp has a long history in state government. He served in the legislature before. He served as a state Supreme Court justice for several years. And now he's back in the Ohio House. And so he has a pretty good reputation among Republicans and Democrats. He has spent the last couple of years working with a Democrat, Representative John Patterson, on a plan to reform the school funding formula here in Ohio. So he's known to work across the aisle. And, you know, in the past couple of years, we've seen a lot of infighting from the House Republicans as to who should be in leadership. We saw this tension with former Speaker Cliff Rosenberger and the householder people. Then householder went up against Ryan Smith, another House speaker, to eventually win over the speakership. So you've seen kind of this infighting going back and forth between two different schools of thought when it comes to how to carry on as a legislature and what kind of bills and measures should be treated as priority. And so with Kupp, I think what you have is somebody who has shown a willingness in the past to work with all members on several different issues and also be willing to work with Democrats. I actually spoke to one representative who said that a downfall for Kupp, or not necessarily a downfall, but maybe something that could be seen as a con, is that he's too fair, that he'll listen to all the sides, even if it kind of makes some people mad that he's listening to another side of the issue. So he has a good reputation, and it seems like even though the Democrats were, as Jeremy said, they put out the one sentence statement of we don't trust any of them, it seems like even Democrats have had a history of being able to work with Kupp.
Hmm.
But at the same time, I might add too that Bob Kupp is solidly conservative. No one's that's not really up in the air. He's solidly anti-abortion. One thing that is really interesting is he was the co-sponsor of a school education reform bill earlier this year, and it'll be interesting to see. There's not a lot of time left before the end of session, but if there will be any movement on school education reform now that he's in the driver's seat, so to speak. And as far as him personally, you know, he's a llama farmer. He raises up to llama. He has a llama named Fernando Llamas and the Dalai Lama.
Wow.
He's an interesting guy. There's a lot of different parts to him.
Well, I'm wondering if he has any plans for House Bill 6, because that has been, of course, at the core of the householder investigation. And different politicians are asked whether it should be repealed or not. Originally, the governor said, you know, no, it should stay in place. And then he said, no, actually, it should be repealed and replaced. So where is Kupp coming down on this? Jackie, do we still have you? I think we might have lost Jackie Borchert of the Cincinnati Inquirer. Andy Chow, are you still there?
Yeah. So Kupp did vote for House Bill 6 when it was voted out of the House the last time to send it to.
Sorry about that. Desk. Yeah, that's Jackie's deadline.
Okay.
So you were saying about Kupp and House Bill 6. He voted on it originally?
Yeah. So he voted on it originally, but there is a mounting coalition of people, Republicans and Democrats, who want to see a repeal of the bill. Getting into that whole issue, though, is going to be a whole other thing because, you know, there's a disagreement as to how to go about repealing and replacing House Bill 6. There are Republicans and Democrats who want to see the nuclear power plant bailout portion of that bill go away. But there are some Republicans and a lot of Democrats who want to see all the portions of that bill go away, even the rollbacks and cuts to the clean energy standards, which in House Bill 6, it rolled back the renewable energy standards and eliminated the energy efficiency program. So there's a lot of disagreement still, even among Democrats and Republicans, as to how to go about a repeal and replace measure, and not a lot of time between now and the November election. And then after that, you'll have a lame duck General Assembly to end the year.
And there's, of course, the question about whether another one would pass without the, you know, juice of Householder, mm-hmm. you know, being the speaker, being the leader.
Yeah, and then a lot of people, and you got to think about how it plays out politically, but a lot of people would say that if you vote to repeal HB 6, then you're directly voting for a possible shutdown of these two nuclear power plants that ended up, you know, refueling and staying online because of the subsidies that were created in House Bill 6. And so that's thousands of jobs that come with it. So instead of not voting for a bill that would save it, you would be asked, or legislators would be asked, to vote for a bill that could potentially shut down these plants.
Yeah. And Jeremy, covered another bill.
Oh,
go ahead, please.
Oh, sorry. It's just not easy to do something like this. If you look at Republican attempts to overturn the Affordable Care Act, because they had to come up not only with repealing, they had to try to find something to replace it with, and they couldn't. They couldn't agree on anything. And I'm wondering if it's going to be the same situation here, that, you know, they're, in theory, might be the support to get rid of it. But when they come down to, okay, exactly how are we going to do this? It just becomes deadlock.
Mm. Yeah. And I would say that's where the Democrats kind of play in here, because, you know, like Jeremy said, with the Affordable Care Act, there was basically universal support for some type of reform to health care. But in this case, there are plenty, basically all Democrats, who say that they'd be fine if HB 6 never existed in the first place. And there are several conservatives, especially free market conservatives, who would say the same thing. So it does become a question of, do you repeal and just not replace it at all?
There's also a few dark money related bills at the State House that have popped up in response to the arrest of Householder and his associates. Tell us a little bit more about those.
Yeah, so I can start with that. So there are two bills that sort of try to target the idea of transparency with dark money. So you have these independent expenditure groups that are, because of the Supreme Court case, Citizens United, these independent expenditure groups are allowed to put money into political campaigns. But as a lot of people have been arguing for years now, the state is allowed to create a system to create more transparency. So there's nothing in Citizens United, according to good government groups and legislators, there's nothing in Citizens United that prevents the state from creating accountability and transparency measures to make these groups disclose where their money is coming from. The state just hasn't done that yet. So there are two bills being proposed to do so. One is a bipartisan measure that would really kind of just revive an attempt by former Senator John Husted, who's now Lieutenant Governor. He tried to pass a bill like this in around 2009, 2010, and it just didn't go through. And then there's another bill from the Democrats that they say is sort of more directly tied to the issues that happened through HB 6 and this alleged racketeering scheme that would really target the idea of money coming from these 501c4s to make sure that money must be disclosed.
What sort of sway do those bills have, or support do those bills have? Has the governor weighed in on that at all, Jackie?
Yeah, so I'm back. Thanks.
Glad that you're with us.
Once again, third time's the charm.
There we go.
Yeah, so Governor DeWine was asked about this last week at his coronavirus briefings. And yeah, on Thursday, he basically acknowledged that this dark money has become, you know, like it or not, has become part of politics and how campaigns are funded these days. And everyone is, in every race, there's at least one dark money group that is you know, working on behalf of one candidate or another. Of course, you know, they're not allowed, not supposed to be coordinating with the candidate and with the campaign. That's a huge no-no. But that's just become part of it. The bill that Andy mentioned that is a bipartisan bill that is similar or really close to what Lieutenant Governor John Husted was pushing several years ago has the support of Secretary of State Frank LaRose. I think he immediately, after that was announced, came out in support of it. I think just later this morning, he and the two lawmakers on that bill, Representative Gail Manning, who is a Republican, and Representative Jessica Miranda, who's a Democrat, from different corners of the state, from Northeast Ohio to Southwest Ohio. They're going to be talking about that later today. It seems like that's kind of an early favorite for a vehicle if they're going to tackle this, and probably has a little bit more better chance of passing than something that is just being pushed by Democrats.
Backing up, looking at this on a more macro level, you know, new Speaker Cupp said Thursday, quote, "It's imperative to restore the public's trust in our elected officials." How achievable is that really at this point, Jeremy?
Well, people didn't have a very high impression of the state legislature anyway going into this, judging by polls. And now it's an election year, so it's sort of every person for themselves. I think it's going to be a very, very uphill battle unless they can make some meaningful changes like campaign finance reform. The big thing will be redistricting. And that will be going forward long term in terms of getting the respectability of the legislature back up. When you redraw these districts in the next couple of years, what are those going to look like? How gerrymandered is it going to be? And that will have a lot to do with the legitimacy of the people filling those districts.
Mm. We're less.
Yeah, Claire.
Oh, yeah, Andy, go ahead.
Well, and I was just going to kind of jump off of what Jeremy was saying. I think what we're also seeing with people who say that they don't trust their government is that there's just a lack of transparency. And so what we have seen that a lot of people have said good government groups have applauded is the expansion of having House and Senate committees air have a live stream. So being able to see exactly what's going on during the bill process, during these different task force meetings, and then a switch during this whole pandemic to be able to make all of these things a live stream virtually. And so I think what we're hearing from the people is that they want transparency. And so I think any bills, any measures that sort of move that issue forward might be seen as a good step.
And we're less than 100 days until Election Day. So what do you think this federal investigation and Householder's ouster could mean for GOP candidates?
Well, there's not too many Republican candidates on the ballot besides president, legislature, and Congress. You don't have a governor's election this year, or Secretary of State, any of that. You have a couple of Supreme Court races, too. I would say that given how gerrymandered a lot of these races are, you're not going to see much difference either on the congressional or the legislative level. You might have a couple of districts flip and a couple of Democratic districts that were won by Democrats last cycle, especially in suburban Columbus, in more suburban areas of the state. You might hold on to those. And it gives a really good talking point to Democratic ads. You know, you just have one of those slow motion black and white photos of Householder walking out of the courthouse.
Mm-hmm.
But at
Deep
the same time,
narrator.
You know, when you poll on this in October, a few months from now, or in November on Election Day, I think people are going to be more worried about coronavirus. They're going to be more worried about jobs. There's other issues that aren't going away. And this will just be one of them, but one of many of them.
Jackie, when we're looking at the Householder arrest and investigation, you know, the FBI executed a search warrant Friday at the Rife Center, houses the state lawmakers' offices in downtown Columbus. What's the next development you guys are watching for?
Well, there's an initial a hearing this week in federal court. I believe that's on Thursday. And I think another thing that we're watching for is additional indictments and arrests. You know, David DeVillers, the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District in Ohio, during that press conference when he announced the arrest and the potential charges, said, you know, this, they plan to do more. This is kind of the opening salvo that they will be, they had agents, you know, are still working on the case and still interviewing people and following leads, and that there could be more to come, that it could be more widespread than, you know, just the folks who were arrested.
Jackie Borcher, Columbus Bureau Chief of the Cincinnati Inquirer, is sticking with us. So is Andy Chow, reporter at the Ohio State House News Bureau, and Jeremy Pelzer, politics reporter for Cleveland.com. It's our weekly reporters roundtable here on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Claire Roth in for Ann today. We'll be talking about COVID-19 coming up in just a few moments. Stick with us.
Is there something you've always wondered about Columbus? Like,
how did Circleville get its name?
Does Columbus have an accent?
Are Ohio's highways based on American Indian trails?
How much has the NRA donated to Ohio lawmakers?
What happened to passenger rail in Columbus?
Curious CBUS is WOSU's series that investigates questions submitted by you, our listeners. What have you always wondered about Columbus? Submit a question you're curious about today at WOSU.org/curious.
Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Claire Roth, filling in for Ann Fisher this week. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. Ohio hit a new one-day record for coronavirus cases, new cases rather, with 1,733 Thursday. And then on Friday, the Ohio Liquor Control Commission approved Governor DeWine's request to close restaurants and bars early to slow the spread of COVID-19. Here to discuss is Jackie Borcher, the Columbus Bureau Chief for the Cincinnati Inquirer, Andy Chow, reporter for the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau, and Jeremy Pelzer, politics reporter for Cleveland.com. So, remind us of the details of that liquor order, Jackie.
So the liquor order that took effect Friday ends all liquor sales in the state at 10 p.m., but it allows patrons to continue consuming those beverages until 11 p.m. So, you know, other states have done blanket closures of all bars. Or reduced capacity. We've also seen reduced hours, right? Like closing the bars at a certain time. But this order is a little bit different in that it ends the sales of liquor. And of course, establishments that serve food are, they can stay open past 11 p.m. And what we've seen since Friday, when this took effect, is that the state agents that enforce the liquor rules have been out at bars and establishments to check and make sure that it's being followed. And a handful of businesses were cited over the weekend for not following the order.
How are restaurant groups responding to this? I'm guessing not well. Andy?
No, so the Ohio Restaurant Association pushed back on it. Actually, the Ohio Liquor Commission held a hearing on Friday to talk about the rule change before they adopted the rule, and then DeWine signed it. And you heard from different restaurant and bar owners who say that they are very much against this. There were a lot of people, a lot of owners who expressed during this hearing that they take the virus seriously. They understand why they're regulated, but they thought that this was a step too far. Some people argued that it was kind of an arbitrary rule to just say, oh, hey, you know, you can stay open, but don't serve alcohol after 10 p.m. The DeWine administration pushed back on that, saying that one of the biggest issues that they say they're seeing when it comes to the spread of the virus and through contact tracing data that they see, but they have not released, is that part of the problem is congregating or mingling at bars and restaurants after hours, so after later in the night. So after 10 p.m., they see an increase of this type of behavior. And so they were trying to target that while still allowing restaurants and bars to stay open late.
Well, and that's interesting that you use the word arbitrary, because there was a similar order, a curfew for bars and restaurants of 10 p.m. that the mayor passed last week, or rather city council did on the mayor's suggestion. And then a judge essentially responded to a lawsuit against that, putting an injunction on it, saying that it was arbitrary. So this is something that's playing out on a local and a state level.
Yeah. And then I think what we saw, I think it was the city attorney, Zach Klein, who said that in response to that judge's injunction, is that there was a belief, and a lot of state officials believe this too, that the state had more jurisdiction in this matter to really lay out what the rules should be when it comes to alcohol sales. And so that was another argument that was made, that DeWine and the DeWine administration expressed that they believe that they had jurisdiction to make this change on a statewide level.
Hmm. A growing number of Ohio school districts have announced plans to start the new school year completely online. Here in Columbus, the district announced they won't have in-person school till the end of October at the earliest. The governor's announced guidelines for schools to reopen, but a lot of those guidelines were announced before this really big spike kind of has been happening over the last week or so. Is there a chance we're going to see some stricter rules from his office, Jeremy?
There's always a chance. The way the governor has usually handled these things is he doesn't just come out and say something like, oh, by the way, we're going to lay down the hammer, so to speak. He'll come out and he'll kind of give a sign that this is coming, and then he'll, issue rules after that. So it's a changing situation. I don't even think the governor knows what will happen in the next couple of weeks, too. Up until now, he's really left it to individual school districts. He's given them a wide latitude in determining what to do. But we're entering a second rise in cases now. And, he has made clear that he is not ceding any of his power to get involved.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you sort of see these scales going back and forth. And DeWine has mentioned this, where he wants to give as much local control as possible. And so when he laid out those school guidelines, a lot of them were not very prescriptive. It was really, hey, these are the ideas, these are the recommendations. We suggest that you follow this formula. And what we saw is that a lot of school districts did follow that formula. But when the governor was asked, I think it was this past week or two, if he was just going to let the districts decide whatever and not be hands-on, the governor said that he will be hands-on if he thinks that he needs to step in. What we have seen from a lot of these school districts is that they're basing their reopening plans off of this health advisory map. So, if Franklin County is deemed a level 3 red county, then districts who are basing their plans off of those maps will say, okay, they're going to go into a hybrid model where they do partly online and partly in class. And then if it goes to a level 4, then there are a lot of districts who say, okay, we're going to be completely online only. And so what we're seeing with a lot of the districts that you just mentioned, Claire, is that they are seeing sort of where the map is going at this point and deciding that they should just be online for the first couple of months.
Yeah, a whole slew of suburban Columbus school districts made the call after talking with the Franklin County Public Health Department. So it seems like they are, in some ways, taking their cues from health officials on the county and state levels.
Yeah, Claire, that's exactly what I was going to mention, is that I think the Franklin County Health coming out and saying, look, we want to see four weeks, of declining cases. Was a real, I think, a key statement that certainly, Columbus City Schools cited that, and Hilliard, when they decided, they also, cited the local officials. So I think it makes sense that you're seeing that within the county as a whole. And this has been, the state ordered, all the closures back in March, but as we've kind of come out of being closed and reopening, there were a slew of state type orders on keeping things clean and distancing. And then we kind of started to see a turn to where the governor was maybe relegating more of that authority to the local health officials. And just as that was starting, we saw this surge in new cases, and now hospitalizations have followed. So, certainly the local health officials are in the best position to do that, but there still is the question of what will the, could the state do on top of what local school districts are doing, for example.
Mm. And Governor DeWine announced last week that starting this Sunday, the 9th, childcare centers can go back to regular class size and ratios. Jackie, how did he explain that decision?
Well, I think it's probably twofold. So first of all, looking at childcare was closed a little bit later than everything else, right, toward the end of March. But some centers stayed open as pandemic childcare providers. And then June 1st was when everybody was allowed to open, but they still had to follow many of the same rules as the pandemic child cares had been following. So that means no more than 9 children, school-age children or preschool children in a room. That's not per teacher, that's per room. And then the smaller ratios, of course, for infants and toddlers limited to 6 per room. And so that created a lot of challenges for places that were reopening. And while they may have had the staffing to do something like that, maybe their building, they didn't have enough rooms to divide children up. So what happened is you had a lot of providers that were operating at far, far less capacity or occupancy, sorry, than they were before, maybe even as low as 20% as they were in March, all the way up to maybe 60%. There was a survey released that showed, I think, on average between 40 and 60% capacity is what they were operating at under these rules. So being allowed to expand is beneficial for those providers because they've been losing money. Some have been getting subsidies from the state to help offset that, but it's not replacing, in many cases, the revenue that they would be getting otherwise. And so during that time, the number of reported cases from children and staffers was relatively low, considering more than 40,000 children were in these situations. So the governor mentioned that. And also in tandem with that, we're returning to school. And you are having school districts that are starting online only. And someone is still going to need to care for those children if the parents are working and they cannot stay home with the kids. And so, child care services is one of those options. And I think we're going to start to see school districts also trying to, partner with other organizations or come up with their own solutions to that problem. Because I think as a parent, when you hear, oh, my child is not going to be in the building at all for any time, the next question is, well, who is going to watch that child? Because I cannot.
Yeah, you have to work. You have to come on all sides with Ann Fisher. New state rules were set to take effect on Thursday that banned the sale of hydroxychloroquine as a treatment for COVID-19. But then the Ohio Board of Pharmacy reversed its decision that day. Andy, tell us what happened.
Yeah, so the Ohio Pharmacy Board made that ruling one day, and then the next day the governor said that he did not like that idea. And his biggest problem was that he believed that there wasn't a fair process that led to that decision. So he's calling on the Ohio Pharmacy Board and the Ohio Medical Board to hold full hearings on the use of hydroxychloroquine and a doctor's ability to use it as treatment for COVID-19 for a patient. And through those full hearings, the governor is calling for an ability for people to give input, to talk about this drug and why maybe it's important or not. He really he quoted an official with the FDA who said that the use of a drug should be between a doctor and their patient. And so I think that's kind of part of where this is coming from. But of course, as with a lot of things right now, these issues kind of become hyper political, whether they should be or not. And the idea of using hydroxychloroquine has become one of those hot button political issues as well.
Do we know why it didn't go through the normal process to begin with? Was it just because it was COVID and so it was seen as urgent, or?
I'm actually not sure.
Yeah, that's my understanding. That it was a safety concern. And this is actually, I believe the rule was started in the spring, so in April sometime, when we were hearing reports of shortages of this drug, which is also used by people with arthritis or lupus. And there were reports that people were having a hard time getting that medication that they've relied on for years and years in some cases, because people were stocking up on it as a coronavirus prevention or to save away for when they get sick. And I mean, there were some really there were stories of, you know, someone getting a prescription for their goldfish to get hydroxychloroquine. So the pharmacy board at that point had stepped in and was starting a rule to make sure that it was being prescribed in a manner so that the people who had been needing it for other conditions could have access to it. And then I think in mid-June, when the FDA came out and revoked the emergency approval for using it and limiting it only to clinical trials, that's when I think the discussion probably turned to, okay, maybe we should put a tighter grip on it.
But what about the millions of pills that Ohio stockpiled of this drug early in the pandemic? Andy, do we know what's going to happen to those?
Still don't know. The governor says that, yep, we have millions of these pills. And so they're still just kind of looking into other uses for it and what it could be used for. And there's still clinical trials out there to test the drug's effectiveness on who it might be most effective for, if it's effective at all. So there's just still a lot of question marks when it comes to the use of this drug, but there's also a question mark about the side effects and the possible downsides of using it for COVID-19.
Andy Chow is a reporter for the Ohio State House News Bureau. He and Jackie Borchert, Columbus Bureau Chief of the Cincinnati Inquirer, and Jeremy Pelzer, politics reporter for Cleveland.com, are staying with us for more All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Claire Roth, filling in for Ann this week. Stay with us. We're talking politics when we come back in just a few moments. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm Claire Roth, sitting in for Ann today. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. Still with us is Jackie Borchert, Columbus Bureau Chief for the Cincinnati Inquirer, Andy Chow, reporter for the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau, and Jeremy Pelzer, politics reporter for Cleveland.com. The Ohio News Media Collaborative, Your Voice Ohio, released results of a new poll this morning that showed former Vice President Joe Biden leading President Trump 46-42 here in Ohio. That lead is just outside the poll's margin of error. What do you make of that, Jeremy?
I think it's just the latest poll to show that this has been a rather neck and neck race, at least in the polls in Ohio, between Biden and Trump. Conventional wisdom says that because Trump won the state by about 9 percentage points last time, that he's the favorite here. But it's been within the margin of error for most polls so far between Biden and Trump here.
Well, and Ohio would be considered pretty important for Trump. A Republican hasn't won without Ohio for decades. Do you think that we're going to see, I don't know if more rallies given coronavirus, but more attention paid to the state?
Well, if Trump loses Ohio, he's going to lose other more battleground states that he needs to win the election, like Wisconsin and Michigan and Pennsylvania. So if he loses Ohio, it's over for him. I think at the same time that if Ohio won is in a pretty good spot because it's between all these other battleground states. So if you're going from Pennsylvania to Michigan, well, you might as well schedule a stop in Toledo or Cleveland on your way over. But also, if it becomes more of a battleground state on the level of, say, Arizona or Georgia, some of these other battleground states, maybe second tier, then yeah, you'll see more money. Biden's up running ads in Ohio now. Trump has been running ads for weeks here, like investing a lot of money, and you know this could be something close to what we've seen in the past, where Ohio's a pretty popular state among the presidential candidates.
Andy, were you surprised by the poll results today showing Biden up by 4 points?
Not necessarily surprised. I mean, I kind of what you said, it's just outside of the margin of error. So this is still a pretty close race, especially when you consider, like Jeremy said, that the president won this by 8 or 9 percentage points. I think what we're going to see is a difference in strategy from the president compared to 4 years ago. And I think that a big reason behind his win was that Trump was able to flip several counties that usually turn out for Democrats, especially in these blue-collar areas, like the Mahoning Valley was a big get for Trump 4 years ago, whereas Joe Biden has been a candidate who can appeal to those types of Democratic voters or voters who are on the fence for Democrats in the past. That's a block of voters that Biden can appeal to. And we know that the Democrats are really trying to go for those suburbs who have been sort of floating towards the Democrats away from the Republicans in past elections.
The first presidential debate will now take place in Cleveland, Case Western Reserve University set to host after Notre Dame withdrew because of coronavirus concerns. Does that matter much, Jackie, or in the age of pandemic when they can't have, you know, packed crowds before, during and after, is it not so important that it's going to take place here in Ohio?
Yeah, I don't know that it matters so much where it is. I think the place, it matters for the reason you just gave, right? It brings a lot of media and spectators and attention to the site on the ground. The other piece of it is that you would expect that during the debate, you might get some more questions that are specific to the host site. So that's always kind of exciting, right? Like we're hoping that they're going to ask about like Lake Erie and Ohio issues.
I know that place. I live there.
Yeah. Yeah, it'll be. And of course, if they don't, then, you know, the local press always write about that, too. Like we didn't get enough attention at our own debate in our own state. But it'll be weird to not have that presence. And that's one of the reasons I think that Notre Dame said that they weren't going to go forward with it is because when these are held at a university, the university usually uses that as like a learning experience for the students. And the students get to volunteer and get to be up close. And they weren't going to be able to offer that opportunity to the students and the wider university community. I will add one thing on the poll today. It's not outside the margin of error. It's actually within the margin of error.
Oh, it is. Thank you. Sorry about
yeah,
that.
Yeah, I hate to be that guy. And
no.
But it was a 3-point margin of error. And so basically you have to kind of double that. And it's got to be the point difference has to be at least greater than that. So, you know, it's 46 Biden, 42 Trump. With the margin of error, it could be, you know, 43, 45, and Trump could have the edge. I mean, the bottom line is it's very close.
It's very, very tight.
You know, you look to this time 4 years ago and, you know, Hillary Clinton and Trump were within just a couple points of each other. So it's a similar situation looking at this point in time in the last cycle.
Well, and we are less than 100 days out. But there are still more lawsuits over Ohio's process. Fill us in, Andy.
Yeah, so there are two lawsuits that were filed on Friday, one by the Ohio Democratic Party that's really arguing for voters to have the ability to apply for an absentee ballot online instead of the current process, which you can request one by filling out a paper form. The Secretary of State fought back on that, saying that the state is going to send an absentee ballot request form to every Ohioan in the state, every voter in the state. So they believe that that's kind of a non-issue. And then the other lawsuit out there filed by several voter rights groups like the League of Women Voters and the ACLU saying that the state system of matching signatures, so let's say I fill out a ballot and then I give my signature, I send it into the Board of Elections, and then if for some reason the signature I signed on my ballot doesn't match the signature that the Board of Elections has on file, they do have the ability to throw that ballot out. But there is also a verification system where I can return to the Board of Elections to sign it again or to prove that that, in fact, is my ballot. These voter rights groups say that the voter that the signature verification system is too much and is unneeded and could result in the throwing away of a lot of ballots. But the Secretary of State again fought back on that, saying that in this past primary, where more than 1.5 million ballots were filed, they say that a very, very small amount of ballots were tossed out because of a mismatched signature.
And looking more generally, you know, our primary was a bit of a mess, let's say. It was definitely very hectic. A lot of it was last minute. I didn't get my ballot. I applied for one and just didn't get it in time. How ready is Ohio for the general? What are Secretary of State Frank LaRose and the governor saying about our readiness for November's election? Andy?
So what we're seeing from the Secretary of State Frank LaRose is that he's been very vocal about working on these issues ahead of time, being more prepared because they are really ready for more of an absentee ballot by mail system. And so they're encouraging people to request those ballots as soon as possible, to get it in as soon as possible. There are voter rights groups who are pushing back, saying that the process could be better, that the state could be doing postage paid ballots, so you don't have to add a stamp fee or whatever to sending in the ballot. So there are still concerns out there. But as far as what's coming out from state officials, they're saying that they're preparing for a huge influx of ballots being sent in by absentee mail.
Tomorrow is the one-year anniversary of the Dayton shooting, when a gunman killed 9 and wounded 17. The governor shortly after unveiled a gun reform plan. 1 year out, tell us the status of that. Jackie, I don't know if you can tackle that.
The status is it hasn't moved. Nothing has happened. A little less than a year ago, people were chanting "Do something" to Mike DeWine, and I think he took that to heart and put forward a proposal that he thought would do something and was also able to pass the Republican-led House and Senate, which for the last decade has been, the legislature has been expanding gun rights in the state rather than pulling them back. And so his bill would have been the first to really kind of, Republican-backed effort to move things the other way. So even though it wasn't necessarily what Democrats would have done or would have preferred, it was at least a change in the direction. And what we've seen is it has not gone anywhere. In the last 6 months, there hasn't been any movement on those bills. We've had the coronavirus pandemic kind of it plays into that. It's one of many things, but that's certainly not making things easier. We also, the legislature is tackling, are going to have to tackle soon the state's budget. And so it's fallen off the priority list for the people who've been pushing it the hardest. Governor Mike DeWine was asked about this, I think, a month or so ago. And he said that he's still working on it. He's still, trying to work with legislators to push it forward, but we haven't seen that actually translate into real movement at the state house.
Jeremy, what do you think are the chances that it gets picked back up, that any movement ends up happening with that specific reform plan?
This session, absolutely zero. Look at all the things we've been talking about. I mean, the legislature is only going to be back for a little bit, and it's during an election year. So already it's a hot button issue. They won't be back for very long. And then during lame duck session, you still have, Larry Householder's not there, but you still have the same Republican dominated legislature that was really skeptical of Governor DeWine's gun reform plan, Plus, you have all this coronavirus stuff going on. You have, will schools be open? So it's at the beginning, the governor said this would be his number one legislative priority. Right now, it's not his number one legislative priority, and it's not the legislature's number one priority by any stretch of the imagination.
We have just over a minute left, but Andy, what do you think will get accomplished in the next month or so, in the remaining legislative time?
I think there are still odds and ends things that the legislature wants to address when it comes to the pandemic, whether that's steering funding one way or another, maybe tightening regulations or maybe even addressing the oversight issue with state health orders. And then I think the big thing that we're going to hear about is a possible repeal and a replace measure for HB 6. I think that's something that a lot of legislators want to address. And going back to a topic we discussed earlier is trust in the government. I think that legislators might want to tackle that issue because of that.
Andy Chow, reporter for the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
Jackie Borchert, Columbus Bureau Chief for the Cincinnati Inquirer. Thank you.
Thanks.
And Jeremy Pelzer, politics reporter for Cleveland.com. Thanks, Jeremy.
So much, Claire.
And congratulations. Jeremy's getting married this weekend, so that's pretty exciting. We're all excited for you here at All Sides, Jeremy.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. You've been listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Join us tomorrow from 10 to noon.